Welcome to Local Exposure, a podcast about music and the greater Cincinnati scene. I'm Jim Nolan. Thanks for listening. Frank Zappa once said, "You can't always write a chord ugly enough to say what you want to say. So sometimes you have to rely on a giraffe filled with whipped cream." This sentiment applies when you're composing an entire album that tries to navigate the male archetypes in everyday life. From social expectations about what it means to be a real man, to the ever-increasing presence of fascism and hate groups in America, the band Hissing Tiles seeks to shine a light on the assumptions that pervade our culture and ask why they exist in the first place. Taylor Peters from Tiny Mixtapes described their new album Boy Choir as precision buried under pure chaos. The album is dissonant, challenging, and extraordinarily cathartic. The members of Hissing Tiles joined me in the studio to talk about the creation of the album and their songwriting process. Today I'm in the studio with the members of Hissing Tiles. Why don't you just go around the table and introduce yourselves.
Hi, I'm Patrick Applebeck. I play drums.
I'm Eric Zietzes-Desplant. I play bass and I sing sometimes.
I'm Michael Squarey and I play guitar and I sing.
Let's talk about how you transitioned from Gazer to Hissing Tiles.
I guess there's not a whole lot to it. The drummer that was playing in Gazer left the band, and it was all under pretty friendly terms. And we had a bunch of songs written that were kind of moving away from the really heavy, noisy stuff we were doing. I don't know. We were kind of in limbo for a second, and so it felt like a good time for a rebranding. So picked a new name because I think none of us were really crazy about the name Gazer, and got a new drummer.
So you say you moved away from the heavy, noisy stuff, but you still have...
Oh, yeah. There's still elements of it. I think by that, I mean we started incorporating more of like a wider array of influences, like experimental stuff and electronic stuff we were working on, and started writing what I jokingly refer to as ballads, but I guess they're not really ballads.
Well, you stopped screaming.
Yeah. Yeah. I made a conscious effort to stop yelling. It was a big thing.
Yeah, I think the key word is that we tried to move away. I mean, I think we definitely like still retained some elements of, you know, heaviness and abrasiveness, but we gave it a real effort try and do something different this time around.
Yeah, for sure.
One of the first things that struck me in watching videos from your performances is Michael, you play what I guess you refer to as a prepared guitar.
Yes.
And this is something personally that I've wanted to do for years. And I wanted to ask you what goes into your version of the prepared guitar.
Oh, boy. So, well, I was already playing a normal guitar with a pretty weird tuning that was sort of specifically tuned so I could make just like the worst noises possible, like, but do it in a pretty easy way. And I think I reached a limitation on how ugly I could make a normal guitar sound. So then the next step was to just make a guitar that its only purpose was to make terrible noise. So I have two. The first one is three of the same string. It's like the B string. And the three strings are all tuned to the same note, but like a quarter tone apart from each other. So I
just
guess,
enough to cause horrible dissonance.
Yeah. So if you play them all together, it's like really dissonant and upsetting. Mm-hmm. And the best description I heard of that was my dad described it as it sounds like a cat in a dryer.
Okay.
And I feel like that is pretty accurate because it can do like weird, subtle, creepy things. It can also just make like sounds that sounds like a really upsetting like alarm clock or something.
Now, how much of, because I'm thinking of like John Cage's prepared piano, how much of non-guitar elements did you add to this guitar?
Yeah, not a lot. So, I mean, I call it a prepared guitar because I feel like people kind of understand what that is, but there's not like screws or hardware lodged in it or anything. It's usually just that on a table and I play it with a slide. Unlike most slide players, it's usually me like hammering it on in a pretty
Yeah, I usually refer to it as your stab guitar.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's basically a series of like stabbing sounds is the best way to describe it.
Now, did you start with like a pretty low budget guitar because you knew you're going to be?
Oh yeah, I've gone through like four at this point because I break them.
Okay,
and I usually like find either like people have given me ones that they like don't want anymore, like these kind of beat up beginner guitars. I bought a few on Craigslist that were just like people getting rid of their beginner guitars, but yeah, it's definitely not worth spending money on because I'm literally like actually just like punching it with a piece of metal.
The first one didn't you just find that one sitting around, you just hadn't touched it in years?
Yeah, it was I think my first electric guitar. I haven't used it in forever, and it was kind of already pretty beat up, so I still use that one. I have a second prepared guitar, and that's it's two G strings tuned to the same note and nothing else, and that I use to play like melodies and stuff. Like on the first song on the new album called Boy Choir, I use it on that, and you can kind of play melodies with it. But yeah.
So what other non-traditional instruments and elements do you have on the album?
A lot of people have been doing this thing where they put two like sort of trash, like beat up old broken cymbals together, like on like a stand or something, and like weld them together like super tight and kind of like a really quick like chick attack that has like more bite to it. But those usually I think sound a little sterile to me. So what I have done, I have an old metal music stand. Sometimes I'll build like a little fence on it, but putting different cymbals on that, but just one, because you have the bottom being a metal music stand anyway, that creates the resonance and like just enough dampening, but it also gives it quite a bit of bite, and just a huge amount of attack. So if I want like sort of a quick hi-hat sound that sounds a lot grittier or with like a lot more like ferocity, I'll do that. But that's like pretty featured on the album. It's pretty all over the place. And then a lot, there's a couple of songs where I'm playing like just the music stand itself too.
And I think there's a washing machine involved at some point.
Yeah, we did. We had a song where we wanted a bunch of auxiliary percussion, and me and Michael really get into the aux percussion, and we just went into his basement and went through his box of toys, but also kind of just hit stuff in the basement and hit the like the support beam and a bunch of other things, and then found that the washing machine was pretty good.
Sure.
It had a great sound.
Yeah.
Well, how much of these sounds are able to be replicated in a live performance? Did you take any time to sample these sounds or do anything like that?
Most all of them can be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, because they're saying, because you still have the masters for those.
Yeah. When we went into writing this album, we were also trying to rethink the role of the bass guitar in all of this as well. Michael kind of wanted to move towards the guitar as a more, you know, textural or almost percussive instrument, you know, with the prepared guitars we talked about earlier. And so that led to a lot of, you know, the lead melodies and other things like that, mainly being written on bass a lot of the time, like Night Flood.
Yeah.
That's one that's, you know, mainly carried by the bass. The other big thing I tried to incorporate was to be a lot more confident about using my looper pedal.
Yeah. That's
on this record. It's just all over this thing. And there were entire songs that were just based off of loops that we wrote, like Wrist was one of them. That was the first one where I had to be brave enough to write a song where I would have to actually trigger the loop on and off throughout the performance. And Patrick would have to be able to lock into that. Because, you know, I mean, a loop is static. Like, and drummers, there might be like a little ebb and flow. I mean, to Patrick's credit, he's very consistent. But, you know, it took a lot of practice for us to get that locked in like that.
It's interesting that you totally flipped that dynamic upside down, where you're in a traditional band, the bass and the drums are the rhythm section, and the guitar is the more melodic part of it. And you recorded this at Ultra Suede.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
This had to be one of the last recordings done there.
I think so.
It was among them,
really.
Yeah.
Lucky.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know for sure which ones were after us, but like we heard it was closing or getting sold not long after we recorded there. So it was very fortuitous. It was an awesome place.
And then it was engineered by Jake Tippy.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Sure. What's it like working with Jake?
He is the actual best.
Yeah.
We've kind of done stuff with him in the past where he's mastered some of our previous releases as Gazer. He engineered a lot of stuff from Eric's old band, Till Plains, and is also just generally a very good friend of ours. And so we kind of had a blast working with him just because we have a really good rapport.
I've known Jake since I was about 15. So going like more than 15 years now, I've known Jake, and he's a very, very knowledgeable person, and it's always been awesome over the years watching him grow more and more adept at being a recording engineer. And as Michael said, you know, he worked on my old band with me, and some of that was just like recording down in a basement. So I really enjoyed working with Jake on this because it really felt like we had come a long way, you know, from just doing like basement recordings together and seeing just how good at his job he had become at that point. Because we had never done a real full length together until this one. It was always just EPs or stuff for 7 inches or him like mastering our first couple EPs.
You say that, but there was another LP before this, the one Aces Read Me to Sleep.
Yes. That was me engineering.
That was Michael engineering most of it, but that was mixed by our friend Will Allard down in Louisville and mastered by a guy named Bill Henderson. This was the first full length project I had ever done with Jake. The label, it's through a label called Whited Sepulchre. A guy named Ryan Hall owns and runs it. He moved to Cincinnati a few years ago, mainly specializes in like ambient, almost drone, electronic type recordings. We became aware of him mainly because of this record by an artist called Midwife that came out, I think it was 2017 when that first came out. And that was just a fantastic record. And when we realized that the label and Ryan were in Cincinnati, like he was then on our radar, like from that point on.
And well, I've known Ryan from his work at Sarn Helen and just like being like a really active member of like the music community here. Super supportive, like always going to the interesting shows. If you look on Ryan's like live Instagram story, it's probably like the most interesting show going on like in the evening.
Yeah, definitely.
There's a lot of times when I like see it and I'm like, oh, I'm missing something really cool right now.
And he always seems to be at venues that I've like never heard of. Like he just he has his finger like on the pulse of all these spots that are seem to be doing things that I just have never heard of.
Yeah, you know? Ryan's really great. I'm really glad we were able to put this out with him.
Well, let's take a listen to a song from the album, and then that would give me a good reason to transition to talking about some of the themes behind this album. I want to listen to the song Wrist, which is the second track on the album. I was wondering if you could tell me what the song is all about.
So yeah, like Eric was saying earlier, it's sort of based on a loop that they came up with, a bass loop, and it's me mumbling on it and interjecting various noises.
And mumbling in French.
Yes, there's a verse in French at the end.
I mean, loop-wise, it's an example of me taking things way too far. Again. Yeah. I mean, there are like three or four layers on that bass loop in there, and it's just every time I end up building one of these, it's just how many layers can I build onto this thing before it just becomes too goofy or unwieldy? But the loop was written at one point, it was a practice with just Patrick and I, just kind of jamming things out. And us just kind of trying to lock into that groove over the course of like 15, 20 minutes.
Did a bunch of variations on it and just messed around with it. And
I think the original demo for it has to be around like, 20, 25 minutes long?
Oh, probably.
And then we just, you know, we sent it off to Michael and he
freaked out over it.
Was happy about it.
Incredibly, like, I don't know. Couldn't wait to work
on it. And I kind of want to say, like, you kind of chopped it down and arranged it. Right?
I guess so, yeah.
Just based on all the parts Patrick and I had kind of just messed around with.
Yeah, dividing it up.
Some of that there, and we like rearranged it partially at practice too. I remember like putting that little like gap in there. But yeah, it's really fun. It's one thing I was trying to do with this album is kind of like make like really sort of unorthodox, like quote unquote dance music. So this is probably one of the two biggest examples of that. The other one probably being Idiot Lights.
If there's any time where I can make an excuse to do tremolo picking on bass, I will. And this song is an example of that.
This is the song Wrist by Hissing Tiles from their new album, Boy Choir. We'll be right back. There's a political theme of some sorts to this song, isn't there?
Yes. So this is maybe the probably the most like upfront and like obvious that the lyrics get on the album. But yeah, this song is generally just about like kind of complacency and normalization around nationalism and fascism just in the last couple years. It's the most general song on the album. And yeah, I sang the last verse in French, kind of as a nod to an acknowledgement that it isn't just like an American thing. It's happening everywhere. Like, I think I was writing it around the time when Le Pen was got very close to winning that election in France.
It was a French election.
It was a French election. And sort of, I think that was sort of on my mind as well.
There are some overarching themes to this album. I guess we start with the title of the album itself, Boy Choir.
Yeah.
I know there's some pervasive themes of, I guess, to put it simply, toxic masculinity and what all mm-hmm. that means and how it pervades our culture.
Yeah. I think a running theme throughout the album is the insistence on kind of reinforcing like the same kind of damaging masculine archetype that is sort of instilled in everyone when they're growing up and everyone when they're older, and kind of the interpersonal implications and the political implications of that as well. And sort of trying to do some work with the lyrics of like teasing out how it's not just something that is like damaging from person to person, but I feel like a lot of international and political conflicts are a result of it as well.
Well, I feel like it's kind of addressing, finally, this mm-hmm. idea of, you know, the boys will be boys.
Yes.
And that's the excuse, and that's people getting away with horrible behavior because that's just the accepted norm.
Yeah, the song finally is, I think, I meant it to be more of a jokey thing because we don't have a lot of joke songs or a lot of humor in the band. But it's sort of like a note to myself of like, what should I do when the situation ultimately arises? Because it happens all the time with guys where women leave the room and it's like, okay, time to tell this terrible joke, or like time to say this really sexist thing. And so it was sort of like a note to myself of like, how should I react to that? And I don't know, sort of a reminder to push back against it.
Well, and I also think there's an element of learning how to check yourself.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
I think Michael made, I don't want to speak for you entirely, but I think Michael did make a really big effort to address these themes in a very grounded, realistic manner.
Yeah.
To bring up like real world examples of where these things might manifest. Instead of us trying to make some grand blanket statement about the world at large, just about how these things pop up in day-to-day life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, try to keep everything rooted in like very specific examples and try to use a lot of proper nouns, stuff like that.
I mean, it also comes down to just like, not just the proper nouns, but just like the nouns in general that you use throughout the record, I feel like. Like, I mean, there's a lot of references to like neighbors or streets or like, you know, tangible things in mm-hmm. your world where these things might pop up. It's all very grounded in a realistic environment.
Yeah, definitely. I think subject matter like this can get really preachy and obnoxious when it is presented in a super generalized kind of almost like a lecture sort of way. So I try my best to kind of weave it into like weird little stories or vignettes as opposed to like saying general statements, with the exception of Wrist. That's the one song where it's kind of more of a general thing.
And I seem to recall, Michael, from your Gazer songs, there was a lot of music themed with your own sense of fragility, because I remember that you would write songs about, you have like a sort of a chronic asthma.
Yeah, very bad asthma, and like, I don't know, a lot of weird.
You're allergic to everything.
A lot of weird allergies, and I don't know, that maybe doesn't seem very exotic, but at the time it was like, it's like a weird struggle that I have of literally taking a lot of medication every day for my entire life and until I die. So I think I definitely wrote some songs around that time when I was like going to doctors and trying to figure stuff out about like what is going on with me kind of thing. So yes.
Is that still in some ways in your mind, or have you moved beyond that?
I don't know if I've necessarily moved beyond it. I think I try to write lyrics, or I try to like honor what is most occupying my mind at any given time. So like around the times I wrote those Gazer songs, like that was the thing I was sort of kind of preoccupied in, like sort of the relationship between chronic illness and like chronic anxiety and chronic depression and sort of how those interplay. And obviously a lot of major events happened in the last couple of years, and sort of the thing that was most occupying my mind was how are all these terrible men operating in the world, and how do they gain so much power, and what are the repercussions of that? And so I felt like I needed to be true to myself and kind of get those things out. So I don't want to say I'm never going to write about like personal things ever again, but it's just whatever is most at the front of my mind, I feel like I have to get out.
I feel like you wrote a lot of this record pretty quickly, yes. Lyric-wise.
Yeah.
Like, on the previous releases, Michael and I would split a lot of the lyric writing, like, pretty 50-50 a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. But with this one, you know, he was producing at a very fast rate, and I felt like I was just like, I'm just going to take a step back on this one. I didn't write a single word on this record, because he was on a roll. I was really enjoying what he was writing. I really felt strongly about it as well. And I was just like, I'm just going to step back and just try to write good bass parts.
Well, there are 12 songs this album, so obviously there was a lot to say. In the creation of the album and the ordering of the songs, what kind of thoughts went into that?
I would just say from my perspective, I am a track list order geek of the highest order. I made a series of mix CDs throughout my teenage years. I still own them somewhere. It's like 75 volumes. And so ordering things was always like so much fun for me. But I think one thing that I've also taken influence from in the past few years when thinking of sequencing is like electronic records, honestly, and just mm-hmm. the ebb and flow of those, like looking for the peaks and valleys on those, seeing like where things ramp up, where they reach back a bit, where the volume jumps up, or where a quiet song might suddenly jump in. And that format in particular, you know, in a live setting, if it's like somebody working two turntables, you know, they're crossfading. Like it's seamless. And my thought was always just to try and make it as seamless as possible and have things kind of just flow right into the next thing.
My favorite thing about the album is that there's no intro. We just start, the first song starts like in the verse, not even like there's no intro for Boy Choir. It just starts with Michael singing and we're in the first verse. There's no BS. It's just right at it.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you say that. I didn't pick up on that at first, but you're absolutely right. I mean, you just jump right in.
Yeah, I think that was a general, I mean, I don't know if there's any specific discussion about it, but I kind of wanted to approach this from a more confident place than the last full length we made, which is there's a lot of like intros and a lot of like kind of weird buildups and stuff. And this one, I kind of like the idea of it being much more immediate. Like there's definitely there's transitions from song to song, but the songs themselves, I feel like are very, everything kicks up real quick.
Yeah, I've been on a weird tear with my band's last few years. I've just been trying to like gut everything I can that's not like absolutely mm-hmm. essential. There's another band I'm in that's like most of our songs are about 2 minutes, not because they're fast, but just because like we're just trying to keep the only thing that's essential at all. And I think that is kind of reflected in Boy Choir too.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it certainly works a lot better in the live format, too. There were shows where we would open with Tack Piano, the first song on our first record, which has a very long, very quiet buildup. And I remember a show we played in Louisville where we opened with that, and nobody even knew we had started.
Or the show we played at the tavern where they thought we were done.
Yeah. So
started putting the house.
So we started playing Tack Piano, and like nobody's in the room, and nobody's coming in, and like I think we were to the second verse before people started wandering into this. But with Boy Choir, you know, it's just like 1, 2, 3, bah, dong, and like it's like here we are.
Well, let's talk about some of the other songs on the album. Like, for instance, I was really caught by the song Yellow Cake.
Yeah.
What's going on with that one?
That one's probably had the longest gestation period of anything on the record. We had originally written that, I think, before Patrick had joined the band. It had no drums for most of it. It was just the bass chords. Mm-hmm. I think, Michael, do you even play feedback on that at all?
Nope.
Like,
just
yeah,
those weird jazzy guys in the middle.
And I think, yeah, there was like a, were there even hits at any point? Cause like,
I think there were like, there was like a pretty simple pop drum beat that came in like halfway through.
Yeah.
And that was
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But nice. it was a chord progression that I liked a lot and wanted to keep into as we moved into past the first record and into this new period. So one day I brought it to Patrick because I'm always in awe of just how he's able to craft beats and things like that. So I just let him at it basically, and he came up with that drum part that first night, and we had a rough demo to send over to Michael. That was another night you weren't there. So we had a rough demo to send him just after that first night, and I mean, he had that very, you know, tom heavy beat put together really quickly, and you know, it really gave the song a lot more pep.
It's way faster.
Yeah. It's way faster as well than the original, which just would take forever. But yeah, so that's just how that one came together musically. Bass-wise, I have always been interested in using my instrument in ways that it may not have been intended, which is why, you know, I just wrote a whole song with just bass chords. Mm-hmm. I love bass chords so much. Like, when I was a teenager and, like, hearing, you know, like, Simon Gallup, you know, from The Cure a lot, and, like, what's that song Primary off of Faith, which is like them playing two basses and Robert Smith's playing a bass too, and they're all sorts of chords. Like, that kind of stuff blew my mind early on.
Yeah, and that's a common thing a lot, is Eric will show up with these bass parts that just sound totally done to the point where I feel like I will ruin them by adding a guitar part on top. And so this is sort of the most extreme version of that, where I just don't play anything. I just sing. But yeah,
well, except for the middle section, which is where, as we mentioned at another show we played, where everything kind of drops out and Michael does a little guitar figure, and you know, it's very quiet, but we had dropped out, and I guess the person at the venue thought we were done and brought the house music back up.
It was awesome.
So the album is out.
Yes.
What formats is it available?
It is available on LP through Whited Sepulchre, or from us at any of our shows coming up in the future. It is available on Spotify, Apple Music. It is also available on Bandcamp.
It's probably on Deezer, too.
Probably on Deezer as well. I know it's on Google Play. I don't know if it's on DatPiff yet. I have not heard back from Tidal either.
LimeWire.
Just been, you know, Jay-Z is on that one computer at Tidal headquarters uploading all the stuff that you send him.
But the problem is Jack White is the webmaster, and he forgot the password. So we can't get on there.
Yeah.
He's just...
You can torrent it, too, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I found a torrent of it.
Which is good. I feel like that's a good sign.
Yeah, it's a great sign.
If your album shows up for free somewhere and you had no hand in it, I feel like it's a good indication that at least someone cares about it.
Yeah.
And you're about to leave on a short tour out to the Northeast, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Why is that funny, Patrick?
Because we're going to Boston.
Yeah.
Instead of just New York.
Well, I have a history of trying and failing to book New York City, but that's a tale
like
for
Boston.
Another day. Well, I used to live there, but... So, yes, in October, we are going on a tour. It's 4 or 5 days, Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, Washington, D.C., Boston, and Philadelphia. And then we're going to use that last day after Philadelphia just to drive straight home after that, get home in time for work again and all that stuff.
Tour kickoff is October 15th at the Comet for the Free Loops residency.
Yeah.
Yes. That's also our next local show is October 15th.
All right. Well, then why don't you pick a song that we'll listen to as we leave?
Okay, so we decided we wanted to play Night Flood. This is another one that is based on a series of loops, mm-hmm. Especially that the main figure throughout the verses, that kind of, you know, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do sounding one.
Yeah, that's my favorite one.
Which is, it's a chord. It's a bass chord just played very, very, very quickly and quietly. I think the only goal I had when I started writing anything for this song was I just had the prompt quiet and fast. like in my head for this one, and then I kind of just brought that basic idea to these two, and they helped flesh it out a lot. These guys really should get a lot of the credit for making a lot of the weird stuff. I think I like to think I bring a lot of the raw lunkhead energy to things. Just
lunkhead.
The more like basic pop stuff. I feel like the more lizard brain.
Well, you have two kids now, so you're sleep deprived. You can totally use that as an excuse.
But they're the ones who really weird things up a lot.
I don't know. I would say, so like, this is definitely a song that's a really great example of the prepared guitar, the middle section where like stuff kind of explodes. That I feel like is the most lunkhead because like it's literally me just pounding on a broken guitar over and over again.
Well, that riff was very lunkhead too, because when I originally wrote the bass riff of that, it was way slower and it was supposed to be way more like stompy hardcore sounding. and you guys shot that down real quick.
I don't like having fun.
Well, this is the song Night Flood by Hissing Tiles from their album Boy Choir. Michael, Eric, Patrick, thank you very much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm grateful to Michael Squarey, Eric Zizas Diplant, and Patrick Affelbach from Hissing Tiles for coming in to talk about their new album, Boy Choir. The album is available wherever you buy music, and you can catch a live performance by Hissing Tiles at The Comet in Northside on Tuesday, October 15th. For more information about the album and the show, you can find links at our website, wvxu.org/lx. Local Exposure is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio and 91.7 WVXU. This episode was recorded by Josh Elstro and produced by me, Jim Nolan. The theme music for this episode is by Scott Holmes and comes from the Free Music Archive. Find out more at freemusicarchive.com. Until next time.